This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Amanda Ripley, a senior writer for Time magazine. Amanda has been extensively involved in the magazine's Person of the Year cover stories and now writes about homeland security and risk in Washington, D.C. Her coverage of Hurricane Katrina helped Time win two 2007 National Magazine Awards. Amanda Ripley is here today to tell us about her book, The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why, published in 2008 by Crown Publishing Group. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you.
What led you to write The Unthinkable?
Well, you know, I covered a lot of disasters for Time magazine, and one of the things that I noticed was that the most interesting, surprising stories were being told to me by the survivors of these disasters. Really, really important things about how it felt physically, psychologically, even socially, to go through one of these disasters in the midst of it. And yet this information was never part of official conversations about emergency preparedness or national security or homeland security. And so it seemed to me like this was something important that we should learn more about, which is, you know, how does the brain actually respond to extreme events, and how can we learn from survivors to do better?
How have you defined disaster for the purposes of your book?
I defined it very broadly because what I learned as I went along is that the behavior, the human fear response, is very similar in very different kinds of situations. So whether you're in a sinking ship or a car crash, the behavior is very similar. I did focus mostly on large incidents that had mass numbers of casualties and destruction, but I did learn a lot from smaller incidents, like studying what happens to people in car crashes, what happens to the brain in police shootings, for example, because there's a lot of research there. So we know a lot more about how police officers behave when they are in an extreme event than we do about regular people, but we can learn a lot from that.
How many people in the U.S. actually experience a disaster in their lifetime?
You know, I was surprised by this. I figured it would be very small, but we did a poll for Time magazine for a story I was doing in 2006, and we found that half of the respondents said they had been affected by a public emergency or a disaster of some kind. So they were affected by it, which is an important word there. Of course, luckily for us, God willing, the vast majority of Americans are not injured or killed, certainly, in disasters, but the effects of them can be quite widespread. We do know that disasters are getting more common and more expensive in this country, and there are a lot of reasons for that, which we can discuss if you'd like, but in any case, it does affect more people than we generally would like.
What are the odds of surviving a disaster?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it obviously depends a great deal on the disaster. For example, in the World Trade Center on 9/11, your number one predictor of how you fared was what floor you were on in the building. But in other situations, like, say, plane crashes, your behavior actually does matter more than we expect. So we tend to think that we are doomed, right, if our plane goes down, for example, that either it's not going to happen to us, a disaster of some kind, or if it does happen, there's nothing we can do. It's out of our control. And I think that both of those presumptions are very dangerous, as it turns out, because if you look at the actual research, your behavior matters a great deal, and there's a lot of hope in that and a lot of reassurance. So, for example, between 1983 and 2000, if you look at all serious plane crashes in the U.S., 53% of the passengers survived, which is not what we probably expect. And if you look at why that is, it often depends on how quickly they were able to get out of their seats and get to the exit. And that's actually quite difficult when you're under extreme duress.
How important are professional lifesavers compared to ordinary people in reacting to a disaster?
You know, this is something that I think, unfortunately, has taken hold since 9/11. We've really spent a huge billions of dollars on equipping our first responders in this country, which is all well and good. I think that most of that equipment is useful. But unfortunately, those people are not there in a major disaster. They just can't be, and they'll be the first to admit that. In a major disaster, they cannot be everywhere at once. In California, you know, you should expect to be on your own for 5 days, some people say 7 days, when the big earthquake hits. And, you know, that's frightening on one hand. On the other hand, you're not really on your own, because what we know is that the people that you live and work with, become very important in those situations, and it's regular people who do the majority of life-saving in major disasters.
In your book, you speak about the survival arc, or the three chronological phases we go through in responding to a disaster. Would you give an overview of these phases?
Sure. One thing I noticed in all different kinds of disasters is that people seem to go through these same three phases in different forms. Sometimes they go through them over and over again. But in any case, the first one I call denial, which is not like, you know, the denial we talk about on Oprah. It's like a profound, creative sense of disbelief. And it's amazing how stubborn the brain is when it comes to this. So, for example, Elliot Azedonia, who was on the 71st floor of Tower 1 in the World Trade Center on 9/11, remembers when the first plane hit her building 11 floors above her. And the effect was not subtle. I mean, the whole building lurched to the south, and she really felt like it was going to topple over. And she picked her feet off the ground and grabbed her desk, and she screamed, "What's happening?" And she remembers distinctly feeling with every fiber of her being that she wanted somebody to yell back, "Nothing, you're overreacting, relax." And when somebody did luckily yell back, "Get out of the building," she still did not want to leave. And this is a very, very common, normal response. So your brain works according to identifying shortcuts and patterns. It looks at what it's been through before and tries to fit in what's happening now into that database, and it relies even more on shortcuts when it's frightened. So most of us don't have a lot of points of reference for that kind of disaster, so your brain tries to normalize it. She walked around in circles in her cubicle, picking up things to take with her. She did not want to leave. She took a mystery novel, you know, she took her purse. Again, this gathering behavior is very common, and it's fine. It's just that it takes precious time. And then the second phase is deliberation, which is when people interact with each other. This is extremely important. People become very social creatures in disasters, even if they are with strangers. It doesn't matter. There's an instant kind of camaraderie that springs up, and people check with each other before making a move, if they possibly have any time at all. So that's important to understand. And then the third one is what I call the decisive moment, when you take action of some kind, and that depends utterly on what has happened in the previous two phases and what's happened in the rest of your life until now.
What characteristics are most helpful in allowing someone to survive a disaster?
You know, it's funny because again and again, the one thing that I saw come up consistently, because, you know, it sort of depends on the disaster for a lot of things, but the one thing that you do see again and again is that your attitude actually matters. Now, this sounds kind of soft and ridiculous, and so I didn't take it too seriously at first, but then I saw a lot of really good quantitative research on this, particularly among military psychologists and people who look at post-traumatic stress disorder. And your attitude going in to an extreme life or death situation actually has a huge effect on your behavior during the event and also your recovery afterwards. So if you believe that you have control over your destiny, and if you believe that good can come from turmoil, that kind of resilient attitude is worth its weight in gold.
Which characteristics tend to work against survival in a disaster?
Well, usually, honestly, it's a lack of familiarity, a lack of training, a lack of latent wisdom in the culture and in your brain about what you are facing. The good news about that is that it's surmountable. I mean, the brain is incredibly flexible if you give it something to work with in advance. But in the midst of a fire or a tornado or what have you, your brain will not function well with new information. That's important to understand because suddenly going on fire drills, knowing where the stairs are in your building, all of those things make a lot more sense and don't seem as silly if you understand that your brain will essentially turn to mush in an event like this. So you have to have some wisdom already there. And to give you one example, the 2004 tsunami in Southeast Asia, which killed an estimated 200,000 people, horrible tragedy. In some places, that tsunami had natural warning signs. So there are two major warning signs of a tsunami, which is that the earth shakes for more than 15 seconds, or the water recedes. The sea behaves strangely. Fish are flopping around on the sand, suddenly very shallow. In many places, those signs appeared. And in a few places, people who lived there knew that those were the signs of a tsunami, and they went to high ground, as they always did when anything like that happened, and they survived. But in most places, people did not have that wisdom anymore. Animals were actually more likely to still have retained that wisdom than many humans. So I have in my book actually an incredible and disturbing picture of, you know, of the ocean receding in Thailand and tourists and people on the beach walking right towards it because they're curious, you know, they're wondering what's happening. So again and again you see that a little more awareness and sense of responsibility for your own survival, and a lot of this comes down to leadership. Why don't hotels in tsunami inundation zones have simple sort of warning signs about what the signs of tsunami are? Those small things make a huge difference in how you perform.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Amanda Ripley, author of the book, The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why? And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you speak about the disconnect you noted between the potential disasters that are most likely and those that people fear the most?
Yeah, that's a great question. I basically came down to three different kinds of disasters that are wildly underappreciated and underfeared. And the three are lightning, fire, and flood. Fire, in particular, kills more people than all other disasters combined in this country in an average year. And lightning obviously causes a lot of fires, but lightning may be the most common risk that we face, and we don't even think about it, you know? So it's interesting. On the other hand, we know, I think, that there are some risks that we fear too much, like sharks, for example, or strangers kidnapping our kids. Very, very, very unusual. And also things like terrorism attacks or plane crashes. Luckily for us, extraordinarily unusual, but the way the brain works is to weight those kinds of fears much more heavily than other much more likely threats. And there are good evolutionary reasons for that, but we need to really overcome that blind spot and be smarter about what we worry about. So people who are afraid to fly but don't wear a bike helmet when they bike around town are making a mistake, and that's how their brain works, but you can easily override that instinct.
How can we go about improving our perception of risk?
I think the first thing is to know what those blind spots are. So understand, you know, how the brain processes risk. I talk in my book about what creates dread. Dread is the single biggest determinant of what we will worry about. And there are about six or seven factors that go into dread. And if you can reduce any of them, you will do a better job of focusing on the things that are real threats to you. So, for example, a lot of people who are afraid of flying on airplanes, they know rationally, of course, that they're in much, much more danger driving to the airport than they are on the plane. But that doesn't change this dread that they feel, and understandably. So sometimes they will work to reduce one of the factors that causes dread, like unfamiliarity. And unfamiliarity is very high on a plane, of course. So they will talk to the pilot. They will look at the cockpit. Pilots are often, you know, before the plane takes off, amenable to this. And they learn a lot about how the plane actually works. And with that, they end up reducing another dread factor, which is uncontrollability. This is another reason that planes are frightening to many people, is that they feel out of control. Once you learn more about how a plane works, and most importantly, how important your own behavior is, should anything happen, then you regain a little bit of control. So you can kind of tweak your dread equation to make it align better with reality.
What happens physically when people are fearful in response to a disaster?
You know, a lot of interesting things happen physiologically. We tend to become quite strong in some ways, so we gain sort of superpowers that we wouldn't normally have, like the effects of cortisol and adrenaline in particular give your muscles a sort of bionic boost, and you're able to flee if you need to more quickly than you normally would. But in exchange, you know, you lose certain things. So every time you get a huge surge of cortisol in particular, you lose the ability to make decisions, to process new information, to use those higher executive functions that you have in your brain. And that's, you know, that's the problem when it comes to these kinds of disasters, because very few of us have realistic training. So on planes, for example, people often have trouble getting out of the plane. They often have trouble just unbuckling the seatbelt because the device, you know, that flip-up device is slightly different than your car seatbelt. So you kind of get a trade-off there. You often also get narrowing of your vision, so it looks like you're looking out of a keyhole. People often almost always report a distortion in time, so it seems like time is slowing down or speeding up. And there, again, there are good reasons for that, but it helps to kind of know about them in advance, and they find this particularly with police officers and soldiers. If you know about them in advance, then you don't feel quite as bewildered and often even embarrassed afterwards.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but what can people do to more effectively cope when they're fearful?
You know, there are lots of big things and small things. Let me give you a small example first. Believe it or not, one of the tactics that is taught in all seriousness to Navy SEALs and police officers is to breathe rhythmically in extreme stress. I mean, it is literally the same thing as yoga or Lamaze. But it is, as it turns out, the one way for your conscious brain to access your subconscious. So your fear response is deeply embedded. It's very powerful. It's hard to amp it down, even when you need to, in order to make decisions and perform effectively. But the only way we can really access it in the moment is through breathing. That is the one bridge between those two systems. So, you know, they are taught to breathe in for 4 counts, hold for 4 counts, release for 4 counts, hold for 4 counts, and go on and on. And I will tell you, I mean, it sounds kind of silly, but I have found this in my own life quite helpful. Anytime you are frightened or you get extremely agitated, maybe, let's just say, in a traffic jam or somebody cuts you off, and, you know, you need to actually function pretty well in that situation because you're driving a car at high speeds, you will find that doing that really does improve your performance. So it's very interesting to see how such a small thing can make such a big difference. But in general, anything you can do in advance so that that fear response doesn't get out of control and start actually doing damage to you will help you. And usually that comes down to some experience with your situation and the threat, some more wisdom and information about, you know, where the stairs are, how to get down them in your building, who your neighbors are, who can help you if you need help. All those kinds of things that make you more resilient will improve your performance and lower your fear response.
How do groups of people tend to behave in response to disaster?
It's interesting. Groups, I found that to be one of the most fascinating pieces. Groups of people tend to become quite close and attached to each other, even strangers. And we actually see the same thing, interestingly, with chimpanzees. So anytime they're under threat, they cluster together, they show affection for each other. And there are good reasons for that, right? I mean, you know, multiple people is safer in many ways than one person. So it's an advantage. On the other hand, it also can be a disadvantage if the group makes the wrong decision, of course. But it's hard to know that in advance. But you should know, there should be some sense of reassurance that people will generally behave extraordinarily well. They will become very kind and courteous in the midst of a crisis. And it's not going to be like rush hour on the freeway. So people become, you know, your best asset, really, in most disasters. Panic, on the other hand, is extremely rare. You don't see crowds tolerating panic. They don't like it, and they will do everything they can to diminish panic. So that's something that I think is a huge myth about disasters. We expect panic, we plan for it, and that's unfortunate because people almost never panic.
When panic does occur, what triggers it?
First of all, there's not a lot of research on this, to be honest, but there was one guy, Enrico Corntelli, who did do some research on this many years ago, and he found that there were several conditions that had to be present at the same time for panic to occur. And one of those conditions is that you have to believe that there may be a way out, but you may not get to it. So if you know there's no way out, like, for example, in submarine disasters, you don't tend to hear about a lot of panic because, you know, they know that even if they could get out of the submarine, they're so deep under the sea, they would die. So it's the potential for escape. And then also a sense of powerlessness tends to be part of the preconditions, a loss of control, a sense of helplessness. So all of those things can be dangerous if combined. But again, I did look for it pretty closely. And when you drill down into most disasters, you don't see a lot of panic, actually. Sometimes you see crowd crushes, which is slightly different, but that usually just has to do with physics and the amount of space that there is.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Amanda Ripley, author of the book The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In your book, you note that the most common response to the disaster at a personal level tends to be paralysis. What are some examples of paralysis in disasters?
You know, I spent a lot of time talking to a survivor of the Estonia ferry, which went down in 1994 in the Baltic Sea and remains the worst sea disaster in modern European history. It killed over 800 people on this ferry overnight. And one of the things that he talks about, this survivor that I talked to, who now, coincidentally or not, is a member of parliament in Sweden, and he talks about how he was struck by how many people on deck as everyone was sort of struggling to get out, how many people just seemed to shut down and not move at all. Entire groups of people would just sort of sit down on deck as this ship is listing dangerously. I mean, you had really moments to get into a lifeboat and get out, and people would just sort of shut down and sit down. Some people, he remembers one gentleman climbing into a lifeboat that was secured, it hadn't been unfastened, and just lying down as if he were going to sleep. There was another guy who was smoking a cigarette, literally as the ship is going down. And this looks to be like, you know, just shock, right? I mean, it sort of looks like shock. And if you talk to any firefighter or even a driver's ed instructor, they'll tell you that they've seen this, that they've seen people shut down when they're under a lot of stress. And I think it probably is shock on some level, but the more I looked into it, the more complicated and interesting it appears to be. It, I think, is, if you look at animals, all of whom do this, animals do the same thing under fear, it is perhaps an evolutionary response to a threat. So if you shut down and you appear to be sick or dead, we know that an animal is less likely, a predator, to want to eat you because, you know, he could get sick from you. So this may be a defense mechanism that's misfiring in a modern disaster.
What's the best way to deal with paralysis?
Well, it's interesting. The airlines have actually learned about this. And I hate to keep bringing up airlines because I think plane crashes are so rare, but I bring them up because they have more research into human behavior than almost any other industry because they're so regulated and because plane crashes are so frightening. So they really understand this better than most people. And what they've learned is that if they can train flight attendants to literally scream to get off the plane, so most plane crashes end up on the ground and on fire, and you just have a number of seconds to get off before the smoke becomes toxic. And the flight attendants are now often trained to scream at you to get out, get off, and that often works very well. It's amazing, actually, the difference. If they're polite and sort of say, time to evacuate, then it has the same effect as if they weren't there at all, and you see much more paralysis and people moving very, very slowly. The bottom line is that people are very obedient and responsive to assertive leadership in extreme situations.
How can someone find out how they are likely to respond in a disaster? How can we come to know what you call our disaster personality?
Well, it's interesting. There are different facets of it. And I talk in my book about how in some situations it's better to be a man, and others it's better to be a woman. Women are much more likely to survive floods and storms, for example. And there are different reasons for that. But part of it just is a function of learning, you know, how it is that the brain processes risk, how you respond. And you'll respond differently at different points in your life. So, for example, we know that the elderly are the least likely to evacuate when told to do so. This was a big problem, actually, after Katrina. And we talked a lot, you know, after Katrina about the effects of poverty and racism, all of which are important. But I don't think we've talked quite enough about the effects of age, because, in fact, age was the number one predictor of who died in Katrina. And age is a predictor in who will stay behind. So we need to understand that better and understand that better about ourselves, but also understand it when we work on, you know, how to develop policies and how to evacuate people quickly from cities.
What do you see as the greatest lacks in disaster preparation?
I think that, you know, honestly, what is most lacking is creativity. I think that right now we define it so narrowly. You know, there's all this talk of building a kit. You know, you should have X days of water and food and Band-Aids and, you know, that, and that seems to be the end of it. And that's just an incredibly uninspiring way to look at it, I think. I think that we should look at this as a function of resilience because you don't look. Hopefully, you're not going to be hurt in any disaster in your life. But, you know, you will suffer loss and you will suffer change, for sure. So anything you can do to build your resilience and the resilience of your family and your community, your church, your office beforehand will serve you very well. And it's guaranteed. That's what I like about it. And that's how we should think about these kinds of activities. What gives us guaranteed benefits in the near term, regardless? And I think then people are much more likely to take action. And let me give you a quick example over the summer, I have a friend who lives in Tulsa, and they were having a number of tornadoes. And then the power would sort of reliably go out after the tornado, and she would find herself out on the street talking to her neighbors, whom she didn't know that well. And they decided they would have a block party to get to know each other. And because she used to actually work for James Lee Witt at FEMA here in D.C., she decided that this was a great opportunity to build the resilience of the community as well. So they passed around at this block party, they passed around, you know, a telephone tree sign-up sheet so everybody's numbers and names were there, and then everybody got assigned somebody to check in the event of an emergency, and they learned that there was a blind man down the street, an elderly lady around the corner, and one gentleman who had a generator in his house, which is good to know. And sure enough, you know, a few weeks later, there wasn't a tornado, but there was a heat wave. And she went to check in on the elderly lady that she was assigned to, and she was just roasting in her apartment. Luckily, she got there before any damage was done, and they were able to move her to a cooler spot. But I think that's a great example of the kinds of things that we should be thinking about. No matter what, everybody had a beer and they had a good time at this block party, so they got something out of it. But they also built something tangible and something subtle. Those connections and that phone tree, the tangible and the subtle, served them very well.
What steps should be taken at the public policy level to best prepare for disaster?
Hands down, the number one thing that needs to happen is that regular people need to be trusted and enrolled in their own survival. I can't tell you how many high-level officials I have talked to who have said that they didn't want to release some piece of very important information to the public because they were afraid there would be panic. And to quote Dennis Mileti, who's the foremost expert on public warnings in this country, more people have died because somebody thought they were going to panic than have actually died of panic. In other words, withholding information from the public, withholding valuable information and training from the public is far, far more dangerous than the risk of actual panic. You see this again and again, especially with terrorism, things like nuclear, chemical, radiation, biological, all of those things. People are not trusted by the people in charge, and that needs to change.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the message is that, you know, you matter more than you think, and in that there is great hope, actually. There should be confidence that comes with the revelation that we are not all just passive victims should anything terrible come to pass, that in fact your behavior matters a great deal, and if you get to know what that behavior might be in advance, you will perform better and you will recover more fully, which is essential. I mean, we don't just want to survive necessarily, right? I mean, we want to recover.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Amanda.
Thanks for having me.
We have just been speaking with Amanda Ripley, author of the book, The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why, published in 2008 by Crown Publishing Group. For more information, check on the web at www.theunthinkable.com. Again, theunthinkable.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP. dot org.